Paul Schaefer is a legend in the field of radio engineering. He was a pioneer in the development of remote control of transmitters, and he's perhaps best known as the father of radio automation. He founded Schaefer Electronics in 1953, and his company sold more than 1,000 automation systems all over the world. But earlier in his career, he worked in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at WOWO and WGL in the early and mid-1940s, and then later at Wayne Radio in the late 1940s. Mr. Schaefer, thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Randy.
So tell us what years you worked at WOWO and WGL.
I started at WOWO, I'm going to say, in 1943, and then after a while I went into the Army and I went back and worked again after World War II. I went back to WOWO in 1946 until mid-1948, and then went with Glenn Thayer and Chuck Sprague over to WANE when they put WANE on the air in May of 1948 to November of 1949.
Do you have a story about how you got the job at WOWO in the first place?
Well, World War II was on, and I was a little too young to go in, and I had a ticket, had a license, so I was in demand, and there were just no engineers available. It was just luck and supply and demand. And at that time, I was working at a little 100-watt radio station in my hometown of Hammond, Indiana, WJOB. So the chance to go to Indiana's most powerful radio station at that time, WOWO, 10,000 watts, felt pretty good.
Now, how old were you when you got there?
Well, let's see. 1943. I was born in 25, so 18 years old.
18 years old. Bruce Ratz was the chief engineer at that time. What can you tell us about Bruce? He was there a long time as chief engineer.
Oh, yes, he was. Good man, in fact, had been with WOWO a long time. And his assistant was Glenn Thayer, who went on, as was Chuck Sprague. They went on to put WANE on the air. But Bruce was a good guy. He was all engineer, and he spent a lot of time with Westinghouse.
How big was the engineering staff at that time? Sounds to me, between the different things that were going on, WOWO, WGL, and then WOWO-FM, there were a lot of responsibilities for engineers.
Well, yes, but as time changed, of course, originally, at that time, you had to have an engineer on duty at the transmitter, and typically one at the studio. So you'd have two on at any given time for each station, and then there were other duties. For instance, I worked both the transmitter at WOWO, which was out at the junction of 30 and 33. I think that was north of town. And then I also worked downtown with the studios on Harrison Street up on the second floor, in fact, up above Gunner's Bar, which was convenient. We could take the elevator right down to Gunner's, which we had been known to do from time to time. Well, I was just thinking of a funny situation that happened one time when a bunch of us, there was a broadcast, I think it was a president speaking, I believe, on the network. And so three of us went down to Gunner's and had a drink or two. And I went back upstairs alone first. And as I walked in the studios, I heard all of a sudden from two sides of the aisle, someone who said, I heard one announcer saying, this is the blue network. And the announcer on the other network said, this is the red network. And I thought, whoops, we need station ID. So I ran into one control room and said, this is WOWO Fort Wayne. Ran into the other one and on the air said, this is WGL Fort Wayne, and went back into the network. So I excellent timing.
So now, did you do announcing at the time as well, or was that just kind of an unusual thing then?
No, that was unusual. Later, I did everything, but sometimes I would get involved on the air, but usually not very often, although I did then start to do remotes, that is, we do on-the-air news, and I'd be on the air a little bit, and then later a little bit more. But basically, at WOWO, I was just a quote, engineer, unquote. At WANE, I started out there being just an engineer, but then times were very, very tough, so I became the first combo operator in that area, where I just had a pair of turntables and a microphone in front of me, and I, in effect, worked both sides of the glass on one side of the glass. But going back to WOWO, what I remember most is when I worked the very, very early morning shift, sign-on, up until around noon, Jay Gould was on the air from sign-on for an hour or two, and then Bob Sievers came in. It was just a very, very pleasant experience working with Jay and Bob. And then, again, in the early days, we had, boy, we had live musicians, because I remember I'd finished the show with Jay and then drop the channels, run down to the big studio, I think it was Studio A, where we'd have a live show. The mics had already been set up, so then I'd mix that show. And boy, with that, we had groups. There was, let's see how many names I can remember, the Blackhawk Valley Boys and the Hoosier Cornhuskers and Judy and Jen, Happy Herb Haydworth, Nancy Lee and the Hilltoppers, and boy, there were just a whole bunch of wonderful entertainers. Again, they were live for quite a while until radio changed a bit, but those were the good old days.
I understand, Mr. Schaefer, that you were also involved in the engineering side of the Hoosier Hop, which was a national network broadcast, wasn't it?
That was. First, we did it locally, and then there was a big, out in the country, big stage.
Buck Lake Ranch in Angola, was that it?
Yes, Buck Lake Ranch.
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, the first broadcast was there. There was some heavy rains, and the cars couldn't get in or out without being towed through the mud. It was a disaster, except we got in, we did the broadcast, and we fed ABC. And then you had all of the fun, some of the names I mentioned earlier, but that it was a big show, and we fed it to ABC for quite a while.
And that was done via phone lines? Tell us a little of the technical aspects of that.
Oh, yeah, over a phone line. If we were lucky, we could get a B line. I think we usually got a B line, so we got up to maybe 5 kilohertz. Some stuff we would feed on C lines where, boy, it was a pretty skinny line. That was great fun.
This may be a little more detail than you can remember 60 years later, but how many studios were in that facility for the two and later three stations that were running there?
Well, there on Harrison, seemed to me, we had a couple of just little booths. Let me think, if I start with letters, there was a Studio A, which was, as I recall, was the biggest. Studio B was also large. Studio C was kind of a library setting. I remember doing a show there in the afternoon, news from the Christian Science Monitor, excellent news show, that we did in C. And so there had to be also, I'm guessing, D and E. There was one right off the master control. I remember vaguely, well, the two on two sides of the aisle, they had WGL on one side and WOWO on the other. So there were the two big studios, the C, which was a medium-sized, kind of like a library, and then a couple of small, basically announce booths with a control room on the other side.
Now, when you were downtown, you were essentially like a board operator there. You didn't do a lot of hands-on component technical things, I guess. Is that right?
Well, I did. Basically, I was a board operator, but because I was also a ham, I had some knowledge of how to fix things, which is why I was able to work the transmitter also, because I remember the WOWO transmitter at 30 and 33 was a monstrosity. Now, a 10-kilowatt transmitter you can put in one little tiny rack, but then it took up two big floors, a whole house. We had generators and water pumps in the basement and water-cooled tubes. In fact, I remember there was a water-cooled tube that I had to change one Sunday morning. And boy, by the time you shut down the pumps and turn the water off and then open the transmitter up and disconnected the pipes and everything, the connectors, and the tube was big enough barely to get your arms around. It was a big old transmitter. It was out in the country. We did have a big old generator because it was not unusual to lose power out there. So we were able to stay on the air whether we had commercial power or not.
And the transmitter was water-cooled. I've seen photos of some other radio stations of that era who maybe had fountains out front or some other thing where that heated water would go. Where did the water go for that transmitter?
It was just circulated.
So it just went essentially below ground and back up again?
That's right.
Yeah. I've seen some photos of the transmitter site. It essentially was like a house out there, but a two-story house. Is that right?
That's right.
You were there during World War II. Can you talk about maybe how that affected either the way the station was operating or the programming that was on the station at that time?
Well, the fact that it was wartime meant, among other things, that we couldn't mention what the weather was on the air.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've never heard that. Why was that?
Well, because the enemy could listen to these stations and get weather reports, basically. In fact, there was a show that came out of Chicago. I want to say it was the Breakfast Club, maybe with Don McNeil, where the show always started with, "It's a beautiful day in Chicago," no matter what it was. But there were patriotic programs, of course. I don't remember anything in particular except the fact that we couldn't really broadcast what the weather was at any given time.
That's fascinating. One of the announcers during your time at WOWO was a young man by the name of Hilliard Gates, who many people would remember as a TV pioneer at WKJG-TV. But tell us about his early days at WOWO.
Hilliard was basically a sports announcer. Then he went on as part of another radio station in Fort Wayne. But I worked with Hilliard, mostly on remotes and sporting things. Jay Gould was a personality. Bob Sievers was, too. Bob was also a ham radio operator. He had this big, big, booming voice. And I remember he showed me when people were going single sideband on the ham bands, Bob didn't do it. He had a great, big, monstrous, probably 5-kilowatt AM transmitter so that even on the ham bands, you could hear his big, deep, deep voice. But it was Jay who I spent an hour or two each morning, and it was a personality thing, and it was fun. It was fun working with Bob, too, and all of the group. I think something that I read on your stuff was Hilda Wehrmeyer. Hilda was always that very large, beautiful lady who was always at her desk, no matter what time you came in, no matter what time you went home.
Now, what did Hilda do at the time you were there? Because she had a lot of different jobs through the years. She was there, gosh, I bet 40 years.
Yeah, she was there a long, long time. Basically, no matter what her title was, she ran the nuts and bolts of the station. It seemed, and I remember her as being more in accounting. She was always there.
Now, do you recall, you mentioned Bob Sievers and Jay Gould, were they using the name The Little Red Barn at that time on their show?
Yes, that's what Jay called his show, which was really, and this was a show where the music was recorded until we went live down to the big studio. I remember frequent references by Jay of The Little Red Barn.
You mentioned recording. That's another topic that I think is kind of interesting. Tell us about the recording technology of that era. Were you playing acetates?
Actually, I remember testing a wire recorder later. The only thing that we recorded were acetates, mostly the 16-inch, and then during World War II, aluminum was scarce, so the big 16-inch acetates were glass-based, and when we dropped one, that was it.
How many plays could you get out of one of those? Would they deteriorate after you played them a while?
Sure, but nothing got played that much. The 16-inch disc, in fact, we had what they laughingly called a portable recorder, which was a humongous suitcase, two of them really, that we would take out into the field and record. I think it was 15 or 30 minutes we got on a disc. I can't remember for sure now. But we wouldn't play a program that many times. And even when we started recording spots on, let's say, a 12-inch disc, they didn't get played till they wore out. If they did, we could do them again.
Would there be multiple spots on one 12-inch disc, or how did that work?
There were eventually, but I do remember that there were 16-inch discs, and finally there were some smaller discs that came along, but I'm a little fuzzy on that.
You were there at the time W49FW first signed on the air, which, of course, was Fort Wayne's first FM radio station, and eventually became WOWO-FM. What do you remember about that?
Originally, I would go up because the transmitter was right there, and it was a little low-power transmitter, but in that I had a license, I could run the turntables and be in charge of the transmitter. But it was just a very simple operation. In fact, I remember one of the announcers was a lovely 17-year-old young lady. I remember because she was featured in the magazine 17 at that time. But it was just a simple operation where we played music. In fact, I'm beginning to remember that we had a music library. World comes to mind as the name of the library. But these were, I think they were not acetates, they were pressings. And they played from the inside out. Later on, when we recorded on the 16-inch acetates, we could play inside out or outside in. So we would sometimes start on the outside, play in, and then start the next recording, if it was a continuation of the same program, and play inside out, because the frequency response on the inside, closer to the center of the disc, was much limited. You didn't get as many highs. So by not jumping from outside to inside in the middle of a program, it wasn't so noticeable.
Oh, that's interesting. Can you tell us about the programming of the FM station and maybe how it differed from the AM?
Oh, yeah. The FM station was really nothing but music. I don't think we had any commercials. I think it was basically just music with announcing what we were playing.
And what kind of music was it? Was it big band?
No. Whether it was classical or semi-classical, I don't remember. But it was music from this transcription service that we played. It was definitely laid back.
Now, the FM transmitter was there at the downtown studios. Was the antenna just, what, up on a tower on the roof?
Yeah, that's all it was. And it was really fairly low power. It seems to me it was only on the air, I want to say, 6 or 8 hours a day. It was very limited.
It started out at 44.9 megacycles, and then it was moved up to 96.1 when the whole FM band was moved. Were you there when that whole frequency shift happened?
No.
So that was after you left?
Yeah, or while I was gone.
Tell me about that for a moment. Your service in World War II, you were in the Signal Corps, is that right?
Yes, but I got in late because of my age, and I went into the Signal Corps, and I was in less than 3 years.
Well, then starting in 1948, after you left WoWo, you went with a couple of former WoWo employees, right?
That's right. There was Glenn Thayer and Chuck Sprague, and there was a third partner who was the Washington attorney. I think his name was Melvin Smith. Three of them got a license for WANE and went on the air, and they had hoped to get affiliation with CBS, but were not able to. So we just started playing records, which was different then. It was generally thought that if you didn't have a network, you couldn't survive. But it was interesting and it was fun. And we did some newscasts. In fact, even at WOWO, there were a couple of big fires downtown. And if there was a big news event, I would locate a telephone line, even if I had to go up a pole to get it, and dial into the station, and we'd cover some of these things live, which was pretty unusual for a small station like WANE, but as I remember doing it for WOWO once also.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So if you did a news remote, there was no wireless UHF or any other thing where you could contact the station. It was all telephone lines.
Yes. Later on, after the war, when I got out of the Army, it wasn't at WANE. I went on to another station at one point in Norfolk, Virginia, and we got a surplus tank transmitter, and that was the first wireless news coverage we did. I did that for the floating of the battleship Missouri, and we did that live.
Wow.
From the ship. But in Fort Wayne, it was during my time, there was never any wireless news coverage or wireless broadcasting.
Now, I understand one of the things you did at WANE was broadcasts of the Fort Wayne Daisies. Tell us about that.
That was interesting. Well, first of all, there was a Fort Wayne team. Was it baseball? Basketball?
The Zollner Pistons?
I think it was the Zollner Pistons.
Yeah.
And they were playing Wichita. I remember the call letters KFH. I remember making a deal with KFH to feed us the coverage of the game. And I, looking for a sponsor, they didn't tell me that GE didn't sponsor anything, that they didn't buy any airtime. So I didn't know. So I went to the Fort Wayne GE plant and talked to the highest person I could get to and told them I thought they had to sponsor this particular broadcast. Well, they did. They sponsored the series. And as a result of that, then later I talked them into sponsoring the Fort Wayne Daisies baseball team. And Dick Buckley was an announcer at that time at WANE. I remember we would do the home games, and then we would do the games away, which, you know, were all fed by telephone line. So I would go out and do color on those. So I was beginning to do more and more airtime. And that was great fun. There were a lot of funny things that happened as a result of girls' baseball. And these girls were good-looking. They were really nice-looking. And they played in short shorts. And they would slide into a base. I don't know how they did it, because it had to hurt. But we had to finally just try to disassociate ourselves with things we would ordinarily say covering a baseball game, like, you know, two balls on IZ and things like that. we just had to forget it. If we said it, we'd try not to laugh.
Well, of course, the Fort Wayne Daisies were in the league that were eventually, the story was portrayed in the movie A League of Their Own.
Exactly right. They were in that league. Well, when the movie came out, the Daisies weren't still in existence, but it was definitely that league because the other teams in that league were from that area of the U.S. That was a very, very fun time.
I have enjoyed talking about WOWO and WANE, but you went on to some much greater things later in your career. You went to Norfolk, but then after that, you went to NBC Hollywood, which was, of course, the home of some of the biggest radio shows ever. Tell us about some of the shows you worked on there.
Well, that was the golden years of radio, or the end of the golden years of radio, when WANE was sold, and I went on to WNOR in Norfolk, Virginia for 6 months, and then came back, and I decided life was too short to live in the cold, cold north. So I didn't have the pot or the window, but I decided I was going to go to California, and I took a car for a dealer in Chicago and gave a $50 deposit, and I drove a Chrysler to California. When I got to Los Angeles, I turned the car in and got my $50 back, and then I started looking for a job. And they actually hadn't hired anyone at NBC for 10 or 15 years. There were no jobs available, but I applied for a job there, and then I did whatever I could to support myself in the meantime. Worked on ship-to-shore transmitters on yachts down at Newport Beach, and I even taught a communications class at a school in L.A. I'd study all day to be able to keep up with the kids in the class in the evening, but finally I got a job at NBC as summer replacement, and then I stayed on. But that was a lot of fun because I had come from local station radio. The typical NBC engineer at that time was a board operator, and that was it. They really didn't know how to fix anything or install anything. And so I became in demand on some shows. And also the fact that I could handle turntables and the board at the same time, which they weren't used to doing, I was in demand for some fun shows.
And tell us some of the shows you worked on. What were they?
Well, I did all of the Carlton E. Morris soap operas, One Man's Family, One in My House, and I did some whodunits. I'm trying to think of the one that I did on a Saturday. My wife went into labor. I did the dress rehearsal on Nightbeat. That's what it was. Frank Lovejoy and Nightbeat. And I did the rehearsal, and I went to the hospital. And my son Rob was born, and I got back in time to do the show. It's the show live on the network.
That's a great story.
And of my four sons, Rob is the only one who went into the broadcast industry, I guess. But yeah, there were some fun shows there at NBC.
How long did you work at NBC?
Let me see. It was 2-3 years, because when I was working at NBC on In fact, I remember Kenny Hicks was working Master Control. Funny, these names I've not thought of in years, but when I think of what happened, some of them come to mind. I remember there was a Sunday morning when Hal Gibney, who was the well-known announcer on Dragnet, and I used to work Dragnet with Jack Webb, too, but on a particular Christmas morning, there was the engineer and the producer who worked for the network would sit in the control room, and then the announcer would sit in the announce booth, and this particular announcer was Hal Gibney. And on Christmas morning, the producer had made arrangements with me to cover him because I knew where to pick up the script, I knew how to do the timing, so no need for him to come in on a Christmas morning. You know, I could cover for him easily. But he would frequently cover for Hal Gibney because if Hal didn't make it, the producer could easily go around to the announce booth and close off one show and start up another, because everything else was on tape, reel-to-reel tape at that time from the control room where I worked. And that particular morning, I was covering for the producer, and Hal Gibney didn't show up. So I ran around to the announce booth, and I remember I had to say something like, "Double or Nothing is produced and transcribed in Hollywood. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company." And then run back and switch the tapes, and then run back again and drop the word "transcribed" into the opening announcement, and back to the control room. And I remember Kenny came, after all this happened, came from Master Control around to the Studio J control room with this funny look on his face. He says, "Paul, was that you?" I said, "Yeah." "Oh, God." He said, "Well, I guess I don't have to report anything because everything went according to plan." But as I was walking out of the artist's entrance of NBC that morning toward the parking lot, Hal Gibney was walking in from the parking lot. And he said, "Paul, did the producer cover for me this morning?" I said, "He didn't come in this morning." So there's absolute panic in Hal's face until I told him that I covered for him.
Well, now, after NBC, everyone in the radio business today recognizes the name Schaefer Electronics. So let's talk about that a little bit, at least. I understand your first product was a remote control system for transmitters. So what convinced you to start designing that, and tell us about that?
Well, that, as a matter of fact, the same Kenny Hicks from Master Control got a call one day from somebody calling from the outside asking if there was an engineer around there who knew anything about transmitters and local station and stuff. And so Kenny said, "Well, yeah, I'll refer you to Paul Schaefer." So this guy had a chance to buy a CP or a license near Las Vegas and wanted me to go over there and look at the site and so forth and recommend whether he should buy it or not. And so I, for $500, I went to Vegas, in this town right outside of Vegas, had this transmitter, and I looked at it and I thought, "Oh, this, no way to make any money with this operation." It was already off the air. And so I went back and I said, "No, especially you've got a transmitter away from the studios. You know, you've got to man both locations." I said, I can't recommend it." He said, "Oh, no, there's a new ruling that just passed with the FCC that now you can operate your transmitter by remote control." I said, "Oh, really?" So I went back, and I had not read a broadcasting magazine during the few years I'd been with NBC, so I got a hold of one, and I looked, and I see all these radio stations applying for approval to operate their transmitter by remote control. And so I looked at, there was one in Oakland, California, KROW, and I called KROW and asked for the owner, the manager, and I talked to him, and he said, "Yeah," he said, "but says there's a guy who's starting to build them, but you have to wait for a year to get delivery." And I said, "How much they cost?" He said, $3,000 or something. And I said, "I'll bill you one for $1,500. He said, "Really?" I mean, I had no idea, you know, what the hell it involved. So anyway, there was another engineer at NBC at the time, Bill Amidon. And I said, "Bill, you want to help me with this thing? We figured we could buy the parts to build a system for $500. And I'd give him $500. And I'd have $500 for my trouble." So we set out to design a system, and we did. And I took it up to KROW Oakland. It had a few wrinkles in it, but the chief engineer up there at the time, Harry Bartholomew, was very good, and he helped me work on it. And at that time, I'd work my short 8-hour shift at NBC, and then I would fly up to Oakland, and then, in fact, I was working a later shift then, because I remember the only sleep I got was on the plane flying up to Oakland, and then we'd work all night, and then flying back. And we finally got that thing on the air, and I collected the $1,500, and I offered Bill Amidon, I said, tell you what, I'll give you half the company instead of the $500. He said, no. He said, I don't want to take a chance. So that was the beginning of Schaefer Electronics.
And he regretted that the rest of his life.
I'm not sure.
Well, then you really hit the big time with the Schaefer Automation System. How long did it take to get that first unit designed and built and on the air somewhere?
Well, first of all, I started installing these remote control systems, and I charged, I don't know, an extra $1,000 or something to install them. But I tell people they could install them themselves, but because I was going to do it in one night, and it was going to cost like $1,000. But some of them insisted that I do the installation. One of the groups, Carl Heyman, owned KMO in Tacoma and KIT in Yakima, and I installed and sold both of those systems. And then his son, Dexter Heyman, owned KGWE in Bakersfield. He wanted a remote control system there, so I installed that. So as time went on, I got a call from Dexter Heyman, the owner of KGWE in Bakersfield, asking me to come up to Bakersfield for dinner one evening. He wanted to talk to me about a project. So I went up and we had dinner. And he said, look, he said, I could put a remote control system in a telephone answering service if I just had something to automatically assemble a program on the air, like automatic radio. He said, what would it cost to do that? And so, you know, on a napkin, I figured, well, let's see, if we took a Seeberg or two Seebergs, and we could put 145s into each one, and we could then maybe a couple of tape decks, let's say three tape decks, and then we would just set up a switching system on silence. And I said, I suppose that would work. And he said, what would it cost? And I figured, well, $7,000. So he opened a checkbook and he wrote me a check for $7,000. And I said, Dexter, what if I don't want to build it? He said, then don't cash the check. So after carrying the check around for a week, it sounded like a pretty good idea. I told him at the time I didn't really think it was a very good idea, but anyway, that was the first automation system.
Now, were those just conventional Seeberg jukeboxes you were using?
Yeah. Well, not a jukebox, but Seeberg made a player that would play. You could select any one of the 100 discs either side. Mm-hmm. And play them. In other words, they would just play in order automatically, or you could give it a signal to start the next disc. It was an automatic player, but it just held 145s. In fact, I think the model was 200LU or something. But that, and some old tape recorders, and that was it. That was the system.
If somebody set this up at their station, how long would it run essentially unattended without somebody doing something for it?
Well, first, we would have, I think we had put station breaks on one tape recorder, reel-to-reel tape recorder, and commercials on another one, and it just depended how, and announcements, whatever, it depended on the length of what we could record on those, but it was pretty easy to run 8 hours. But it was fairly sloppy programming because it was all silence since switching until we got fancy. In fact, the first one I installed there at KGWE in Bakersfield, and then I put a system in a trailer, and I started hauling the trailer around to show radio stations how it worked. And the first demonstration I made was at KDB in Santa Barbara, and one of the two owners was a good engineer, and he looked at it, he loved it, and they bought a system, and he installed it, and then he told me he wanted to come and work for me because he could see ways to improve it. And he thought it was much more fun than owning and running a radio station. So he, Jim Harford, left KDB in Santa Barbara and came down to the L.A. area. And, in fact, his chief engineer at that time, Bob Levinson, came down also. And Bob was head of my manufacturing, my assembly, for many years. And finally, we were selling a lot of systems, and it was more trouble trying to sell the contract. I typically sell an automation system on a contract with payments, so I was having more trouble selling the paper, the contract, than I was selling the systems. So somebody put me in touch with a little company called Textron, and I went to Providence, Rhode Island, and met Royal Little, president and chairman of the board of Textron. We got to working together, and eventually he talked me into a deal whereby I would be acquired by Textron, and for a year or two operated as a president of a division of Textron, and then they were going to sell Textron Electronics to the Lionel Corporation, and Lionel backed out. So Royal Little called and he said, "Paul, I have every confidence that you will come and make me an offer according to the contract to buy Schaefer Electronics back, and we'll make a deal." Well, turned out we made a deal by Schaefer Electronics back from Textron, and at that time I brought Jim in as a 50% partner of our new corporation, and we went on to the next step.
Now, in those early days, automation was certainly a radical concept. After you got it on that first station, was it kind of a tough sell to get it on more stations or not?
No, it began to move very quickly. Well, in fact, a lot of people were skeptical. So after the first automation system in a trailer worked out so well, I bought a motorhome, and I put the automation system in the motorhome, and that worked so well, I bought two more motorhomes, and I had three guys traveling the United States with three systems demonstrating automation to people. And once when I saw this thing, after bouncing down the highway, sit there and run an automatic radio station in front of them, it was a pretty easy sell.
Now, when somebody bought one of these, did you just have, you know, units ready to go, or were you essentially custom building them for each buyer?
Well, there were differences. It was a basic brain, and then it could be three tape recorders or six or nine, and there could be all different kinds of accessories. But it was a basic system to record, a record unit, and then so many playbacks. Each system was different. And originally, where we played music in 45s, Gordon McClendon was just beginning to do some pretty fancy things with music programming. In fact, Gordon McClendon and Todd Storrs, who I think they knew each other, I think they maybe even went to the same university, they started being very successful with stations programming basically music. When Gordon got interested in this, he said, "Paul, you're doing this all wrong. The music ought to be on tape, not on a 45. And so we set up systems for Gordon. In fact, Gordon sent his key people, his director of engineering and his program director for the group, and a couple of very talented people. When I sold the automation company to Textron, I bought three radio stations. One was in Reno, and one was in Las Vegas, and another one in Yuma. But at any rate, the one in Reno, I was running, and I made a little bit of a splash, running a radio station 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with a total of three people. The chief engineer did the announcing, the manager did the sales, and the gal ran the traffic and accounting and ran the office. And when Gordon McClendon heard about this, he sent his people to Reno. He said, "Let us do all the programming and run the radio station for a week." Well, they did. And of course, it was a fabulous sounding radio station with that kind of talent. And as a result of that success, we began more and more to promote music on tape rather than on records of any kind. And Gordon bought a half a dozen systems, and lots of other companies like that bought lots of automation. So it became more interesting.
What was your best year of sales for the automation system? I'm just curious. What year did it kind of peak?
We did $1 million 1 year and $2 million the next.
Wow.
It would have been 67 and 68 were the peak years. other people were getting into the automation business. And, of course, automation has changed tremendously. Now, with the ability to store stuff on hard disk, automation has just become a whole different world.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. A lot of people in the radio industry will, when they're citing all the woes of radio, will blame voice tracking and automation. And, you know, that can be traced back to your original concepts and ideas. I'm just curious, what do you think about all that?
Well, I was not popular among radio announcers who thought they might lose their job because of a station buying an automation system. I would point out to them, I said, well, as long as you're willing to sit there and wait 3 minutes for a record to play, that's your life. I don't know how successful you're going to be with that. But if you can voice track 8 hours in an hour or so, then you become much more valuable. So the people in the industry went one of two different directions. They didn't like the progress because they felt threatened, or they did well because they embraced the possibilities.
Well, thank you again. This has been a real honor, Paul Schaefer, to spend so much time with us, and you have such a terrific memory of things that happened 60 years ago. Thank you again very much.
It has been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. You're doing a great job, and I sure did and will continue to check your website.